From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
We think that the answer to the question of what makes us conscious has to be a question about our brains. But I don't think that consciousness is something that happens in our brains.
So what does make us conscious? And how should we make sense of our own, sometimes strange, neurological disorders?
I've been a person who has had migraines for many years, and I've also had hallucinations, and I think I took it as a matter of course that my nervous system could produce unlikely symptoms.
Today we'll explore the frontiers of consciousness, from neuroscience to psychedelic drugs, and hear the story behind Carl Jung's legendary Red Book, which was hidden away for 80 years.
It is a remarkable situation where you have a whole psychological movement that's had significant effects on 20th century thought, based in part on a work which no one had read or seen.
But first, a look at the hidden brain. It's the title of a new book by Washington Post science writer Shankar Vedantam. It's a study of how a great deal of our thinking, in fact, far more than we realize, is shaped by our unconscious minds.
Just try and think about the first time you started learning to drive a car. I have a friend, actually, who is just learning to drive a car. She's an adult. And, you know, she's gripping the steering wheel. She's peering intently for cars that are approaching. She's trying to process the changing of the lights. And it's an extremely stressful and anxious process. And it's stressful and anxious because when you're learning a new skill, the entire activity is happening at a conscious level. When I'm driving a car, or when your listeners are driving a car and listening to you on the radio, they're not thinking about driving the car at all. That doesn't mean necessarily they're driving the car recklessly. It just means that there's a part of their brain that has essentially taken over the driving of the car. And that's what I call the hidden brain.
You know, this makes sense to me in so many ways that the example of driving, I can think of examples of athletes, for instance, who will say after a game that they were better because they stopped thinking about what it was that they were going to do. Where this begins to be of some concern, though, is when you talk about ethical decisions. There's a study of office workers who are on the honor system to pay for the coffee that they get from the company machine. Maybe it would be best for you to describe it.
So this was an experiment conducted at an office in England where a beverage station was located in a private area of the office where if people paid for their tea and coffee, no one complimented them, and if they didn't pay for their tea and coffee, no one caught them. A psychologist changed a little notice that was pasted at eye level at this beverage station that laid out the price of tea and coffee. And there was a small decorative image on the top of the sheet of paper. And she changed the image from week to week so that on some weeks the image showed pictures of flowers, roses, tulips, and so on. And on alternate weeks, the pictures showed a pair of watching eyes. And when she finished the experiment after 10 weeks, she asked people if they had noticed that this picture was changing from week to week, and no one had even noticed that there was a picture on top of this notice. And yet this small intervention produced a giant effect on people's honesty levels in paying for their tea and coffee. On weeks when the picture showed a pair of watching eyes, honesty levels soared. And when pictures showed flowers and roses, honesty levels plummeted. And what this experiment tells me is that without their awareness, something in these people's minds was noticing that there was a picture and noticing that the picture showed a pair of watching eyes. And because the hidden brain is fundamentally a dumb system, it's not a sophisticated system, it's a dumb system, it thought of the pair of watching eyes, the picture of the eyes, as being a real pair of eyes. And it prompted the people to behave as if they were really being watched.
A lot of these things seem to be related to our interaction with others. There was a study that you quoted of how much people tip in restaurants, and the results of that were a surprising revelation as well.
That's right. This was an experiment that was conducted in the Netherlands. A researcher got a waitress at a restaurant to mimic her customers. So when they placed an order at the restaurant, she repeated the order back verbatim so that she was repeating exactly the same words that the customers had said. And the psychologist found that when she did this, the size of her tips went up astronomically. That somehow when people felt that what they said was being reflected back to them perfectly and accurately, they felt somehow better listened to, even compared to situations where the waitress delivered exactly the order as the customers had wanted, but didn't sort of mimic what they said when they were placing the order.
This is one thing when you're talking about whether the coffee gets paid for, and mostly it does, or whether the waitress gets an 18% tip or a 20% or a 25% tip. It's more serious when there are issues involved that can have long-lasting impact. I mean, there's some pretty serious social and political consequences that come from this, aren't there?
Where the hidden brain becomes really insidious is when we're making decisions that affect the lives of many other people, when in the question of moral judgment, for example, or in the question of politics. Ahead of the 2008 presidential election, researchers conducted an experiment where they evaluated whether people felt at an unconscious level that Barack Obama was an American. And it was a very interesting experiment because at a conscious level, these volunteers would all have told you that Barack Obama was indeed American. But at an unconscious level, the researchers found that people were more likely to associate the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair with being American than Barack Obama. In other words, they were willing to think about a white person as being American much more than a non-white person who was an American, even though they knew at a conscious level that Tony Blair was a British politician and Barack Obama was an American. And the reason this is powerful is that the researchers also showed that people who at an unconscious level were less likely to see Obama as being American were less likely to vote for him in the Democratic primary and in the general election, even if they agreed with him on all the policy issues. The unconscious bias effectively drove these voters' positions on the candidate.
It suggests that you feel we are all essentially prejudiced, racist, whether we know it or not.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that we all have unconscious associations kicking around in our heads. I'm not sure necessarily I would say that we're all racist, because in some ways, racism, I think, is what people do. It's what people say. It's actions that constitute racism, not thoughts. The point of my book is not to convict people of thought crimes. It's really to get people to understand that what happens in the unconscious plays a role in people's everyday activities.
This also suggests that a clever politician could, knowing this, manipulate the way people are going to perceive not only his or her candidacy, but his or her opponents.
I think that's true. And I think this can work in both positive and in negative ways. And I think it's also true that political campaigns are far more aware of these biases than are most voters. During the 2008 election, you could also argue that the Obama campaign in some ways managed to turned down the temperature on the question of race using some very interesting and subtle techniques. I'm not sure how much of what they did was intentional, but one of the things that Obama never did was he never confronted the issue of racism head on. He did make that famous speech in Philadelphia, but apart from that, even when voters explicitly said that they would not vote for a black man, the Obama campaign never came out and said, look, I'm being treated unfairly. Look, racism is still alive and well in the United States. Rather, the campaign always called people to their better angels and said, look, we have really come to transcend race. We are a better people than we are. And there's a lot of new and interesting research that suggests that when it comes to dismantling unconscious biases, these sideways approaches, if you will, are far more effective than the head-on approach of telling someone, I think you're behaving in a racist manner. Because if bias is unconscious, telling somebody that they are racist is ineffective because they look inside their hearts and don't find evidence of racism and then feel offended that you're accusing them of something that they know isn't true.
Shankar Vedantam is a Washington Post reporter. His book is called The Hidden Brain. The human mind is full of mysteries, as the novelist Siri Hustvedt knows all too well. She has an undiagnosed seizure disorder, which can pop up at the most troublesome times. And it's led her to reflect on the connection between mind and body, and on more philosophical questions about personal identity and the nature of the self. She's written a book called The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. Hustvedt told Anne Strainchamps that her first shaking episode happened a few years ago at a memorial event for her father. With a speech in hand, she got up on stage at the college where her father used to teach.
As soon as I began to talk, I began to shake, but not a small shudder, not a tremor. I mean huge, convulsive spasms. I did manage to finish the speech.
So you could still talk?
I could still talk. Actually, I felt that from the neck up, I was completely in control. All my cognitive processes were functioning fine. It was from the neck down that I was out of control.
What did it look like from the outside to the audience?
Well, I think people were stunned. My mother said that it was as if she were looking at an electrocution. It ended then, and I was left with this striking question, what had just happened to me?
Did you drive straight to a hospital to try to find out?
You know, it's very interesting that I didn't. And when I think of it now, I was so blasé about it, almost disassociated from this event that had taken place. It was over. I've been a person who has had migraines for many years, and I've also had hallucinations, some very strange aura experiences with migraine. And I think I took it as a matter of course that my nervous system could produce unlikely symptoms. I had no idea at the time that it would happen again, but then it did.
At what point did you begin trying to investigate it?
Well, I started investigating it in my own mind almost instantly because I've been someone who's interested in, neurology, psychoanalysis, and in recent years, neuroscience. I belong to a discussion group and belong to one now at Rockefeller University with clinicians and neuroscientists. So I thought, what exactly could cause this? And that's when I got into the strange issues of the mind-body problem. Was this what physicians would call a psychological problem? Was it connected to my father's death? Or was it a purely physiological reaction to, I think, stress in some way, the stress of having to give a speech? But I was not nervous beforehand.
So what did you eventually conclude about the shaking?
You know, it's still really, I have an undiagnosed seizure disorder. No one is quite sure what to make of this.
Do you still have it?
Yes, I still have it, and I medicate myself. I use propranolol, which is a beta blocker. It's a blood pressure medicine, and it does seem to put a lid on the release of the stress hormones, which I think are probably the onset of the seizure activity. But my conclusion, and I make it in all humility, is that I have a rather low seizure threshold, which means that external stimuli, like making a speech in public or being frightened of something, can put me into seizure activity.
So that's, in some ways, what you just gave me is the external explanation for almost the diagnosis of your shaking. But in a lot of the book, what you're exploring are the ways that we experience illness or particular symptoms internally. You know, it's the interior experience.
Absolutely. You know, diagnosis is interesting because in order to make a diagnosis, you have to abstract the illness from the person. In cases of neurological problems and psychiatric problems, it's very hard to remove the illness from the self. And my relationship to my migraines that have been going on for many, many years now since I was a child is that I understood the moment I said to myself, you have this, this is part of you, this is part of your hypersensitive nervous system. There are good sides to it, there are bad sides to it, but you can't reject it and you can't act as if it's some alien part of the self. This has helped me live with it far better than if I were in mortal combat with my chronic headaches.
Well, that's very interesting because it suggests that the story you choose to tell yourself about your illness or about particular symptoms is what matters, that it's how you incorporate the illness into your sense of your own identity.
That's a very astute remark. We all tell ourselves stories about ourselves. I don't think that there is a single true narrative. But the stories we do tell ourselves are very important. And I think that in medicine, often, the narrative of the human being who has the illness is forgotten. Instead of thinking about a story of an illness, physicians have a tendency to look for a list of symptoms. That's a very static way of talking about illness.
You mentioned your migraines and the feeling you've always had that you have an extremely sensitive nervous system. Well, how far back does that go?
It goes as far back as I can remember. And when I was a child, my mother did always say that I was extremely sensitive, overly sensitive. This was the refrain in my family, and I think I bore it out in my character. I'm not blaming anyone for, you know, saying that.
Sensitive to what?
To everything. And not so long ago, when I was writing the book, I was reading some papers about a phenomenon called mirror touch synesthesia, which is when people see someone else being touched or slapped or pinched, and they actually have a sensation in their own bodies of that slap or touch. And I realized I have it.
Hmm. Now, are you also really sensitive to experiences of beauty, for instance? Colors, art, landscape?
Yes, I write about art. I've written especially about painting. And I find that I love to look at paintings, but I can't look at too many or I become unwell. That has a name, too. It's called Stendhal syndrome. And I don't know the original story if Stendhal got sick somewhere looking at paintings, but it's not unknown. And once I had to review a show at the Museum of Modern Art, and there were quite a few pictures in the show, and I left in a state of nausea and migraine. So I have to limit what I see. But I think the pictures that I look at very intensely and feel them very deeply. At the same time, this is, again, part of the story of a personality, a character. And without those, I don't know if you even want to call it symptoms, without my nervous system, I would be someone else.
Well, and for one thing, those very qualities might be what's made you a novelist.
I think it's entirely possible. You know, there is an interesting link between epilepsy, especially temporal lobe epilepsy, and something called hypergraphia, which is the need to write. I've been fascinated by this for some time. Dostoevsky probably had it. Many novelists do exhibit a need to write. Not really writing by choice, but because you have to do it. And there may be a neurological component to this. There probably is.
That's novelist Siri Hustvedt talking with Van Strainchamps. Her book is called The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. So, what's the connection between the brain and the mind? Maybe not what we think.
Consciousness itself is not a microscopic event in the brain. Consciousness is something that depends necessarily on our brains, but also on our bodies and also on the world around us. And if we want to understand this phenomenon, we need a more contextual, a more holistic science.
Coming up, a philosopher rethinks the nature of consciousness. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Back in the mid-90s, the renowned scientist Francis Crick laid out what he called the astonishing hypothesis. Crick had already achieved scientific immortality for his discovery with James Watson of DNA's double helix. He then turned his attention to neuroscience and stated, flatly, that everything to do with consciousness is the direct result of the brain. Here's how he described it in an interview he did with us.
it says essentially that all the feelings you have and what you see and how you feel pain and what you think about yourself and your emotions and ambitions and so on are basically the behavior of the an enormous number of nerve cells in your head firing away and interacting, and of course the molecules associated with them.
Francis Crick wrote, and I'm quoting here, "This hypothesis is so alien to the ideas of most people alive today that it can truly be called astonishing." Crick died a few years later, but his theory about the mind is now the standard scientific view of consciousness. But that's unfortunate, says philosopher Alvin Noe. He's written a book called Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain, and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness. Noe told Steve Paulson that Crick's theory was partly what prompted him to write this book.
The thing that strikes me and that sort of motivates me, if you like, in this research project is the appreciation of just how astonishing it isn't. The idea that there is a thing inside of us that thinks and feels and decides, and that each of us is that thing, that's not an astonishing idea at all. That's kind of the sort of culturally shared, inherited conventional wisdom. Descartes thought it was the immaterial soul that is that thing inside us, and Crick thinks it's the brain or this collection of brain cells. But the thing which I take as my starting point is that we really don't have any better idea how the brain gives rise to consciousness than we do how the immaterial soul substance of Descartes does. So I don't really think there's much that speaks in favor of the idea that, as Crick put it, you know, you are nothing but a collection of brain cells and associated molecules.
So how would you assess the current state of scientific knowledge about what makes us conscious?
It's very early days. We're sort of in the teenage years when it comes to the development of this science. And like teenagers, we've got lots of fancy toys that we like to play with, brain imaging technologies, and all sorts of high-powered laboratory techniques. But we haven't really yet found the organizing framework for understanding how the science should move forward. In a way, I think we simply made a mistake about where to look. We think that the answer to the question of what makes us conscious has to be a question about our brains. But I don't think that consciousness is something that happens in our brains. It's something that we achieve, that we do, that we enact. It's something that depends on our brains. The brain is necessary for consciousness, but the brain is not the sort of soul-sufficient basis of consciousness.
What specifically cannot be explained by this current effort to essentially look for discrete neural connections to explain mental experience?
At the moment, we can find all sorts of very interesting correlations between, for instance, the happening of a visual experience in a subject and an event in the brain, or the happening of a cognitive event in the mind of the subject and an event in the brain. We find these correlations, but we don't yet have any clue what it is that is, if you like, the reason why those correlations are what they are. That is, there doesn't seem to be anything about the intrinsic character of the neural activity that explains why that neural activity produces visual sensation when this other neural activity produces, say, a tactile sensation, the feeling of touch.
Or to take it even further, to explain why we have a certain emotional experience, why we have a particular thought. I mean, I guess the question is, will we ever be able to explain that by looking at what happens in the brain?
Yeah, and I think that the answer is no. And that is because the brain is simply not the place where those events in consciousness are happening. That's kind of a, it's what philosophers sometimes call a category mistake. Rather, my metaphor would be, think of experience as dance. Dance isn't something that happens inside you. Of course, it depends on what's going on inside you. But dance is something you do, and it's something, the very doing of which depends upon the environment in which you find yourself, say the music or the landscape or the other dancers. And that's simply the locus of meaning and significance and quality, not inside us, something we carry on around us. But I want to be very clear that I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't try to explain consciousness or that we shouldn't try to offer a natural scientific approach to consciousness, meaning, significance, personality, the self, the mind. What is, I think, unfortunate is that so many of the scientists who turn to this do so relying on a very problematic, outdated philosophical conception of the mind as something interior. Really, they just simply take the old Cartesian idea of the mind as something inside of us and think that they can use brain science to unpack that.
Well, this makes me think of a concert pianist who doesn't think out how to play a particular piece of music. Somehow it's through the feel of the keys that the fingers know the piece and they work with the brain to generate the experience of music.
That's absolutely right. So much of our actual lives, we are in the flow. We are already wrapped up in a project. If I'm a soccer player in the middle of a game, I'm not in the position of an alien from a strange land who looks at the ball and says, what is this ball and what is its function in my life? I know what to do because I'm trained, because I've got habits, because I'm in the flow. And that's certainly true of the concert pianist, too. The concert pianist's performance would be disrupted if he or she were made to contemplate the movements of the fingers. The fingers are these kinds of transparencies through which the musician is acting on the world.
All this obviously has some profound implications for research into artificial intelligence. And as we've said, there are a lot of scientists who think that the brain basically works like a computer, and therefore someday we'll be able to build a sophisticated computer that is conscious. Are you saying that will never happen?
I'm not saying that, actually. My view on this is a sort of a subtle one. I don't think the brain alone is responsible for consciousness. To make a creature with a mind, say in a laboratory, you need to give it a kind of embodied relation to the world.
We need to be able to build robots that can walk around and interact with the environment and change because of those interactions. Only that will lead to consciousness.
That's right, and maybe even go a step further and say that to build an artificial mind, what you really need to do is give it an artificial world, because mind happens in this dynamic of interplay between the agent and the world. I think it's entirely plausible that as we develop prosthetic cyborgian ways of enhancing ourselves technologically, that we will enhance or develop or at least change the character of our consciousness. So I think that much is right in this kind of science fiction fantasy.
Well, while we're on the subject of science fiction, let me ask you about the movie Blade Runner, which raises the whole question of whether the replicants, the machines in the movie, have consciousness. Is this a possible scenario?
One of the things which is so beautiful about that movie, I think that movie is really a deeply philosophically engaged work of art. To really understand that movie and follow the plot and engage it, you kind of have to do some philosophy. And I think that's a real contribution that that movie made. One of the things it does is it puts you in a situation where, if you remember the main character who's played by Harrison Ford, he's a sort of a kind of policeman named Deckard. His job is to track down and maybe even kill runaway sort of revolutionary replicants. And the whole movie narratively is built on the idea that we just know. We know with moral certainty that it's wrong to think that a merely mechanical or physiological test can decide the question of whether these beings have minds and consciousness or not. We just know that. And even Deckard knows that. Deckard actually forms a romantic relationship with one of them. Being romantically involved with somebody is incompatible with thinking of them as just a machine. So that movie, I think, really shows us that we can't consistently take mind to be merely interior, that we can't take physiological criteria to be definitive of what it is to have a mind, that mind, spirit, soul, consciousness, call it what you will, are wrapped up with the kinds of ongoing, temporally extended interactions that we enjoy.
Alvin Noe is a philosopher at the University of California, Berkeley. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his book, Out of Our Heads.
Why are you staring at us, Sebastian?
Because you're so different. You're so perfect.
Yes.
What generation are you?
Nexus 6.
Ah, I knew it. Because I do genetic design work for the Terrell Corporation. There's some of me in you. Show me something.
We're no computers, Sebastian. We're physical.
I think, Sebastian. Therefore, I am.
A scene from the science fiction classic Blade Runner. What do you think? Will brain science ever explain consciousness? You can share your thoughts by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org, or you can comment on our Facebook fan page. Coming up, Timothy Leary, Andrew Weil, and the story of the Harvard Psychedelic Club, and Carl Jung's legendary Red Book. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Did this man launch the 1960s counterculture?
300 years ago, if I were to say, do you know that there's a level of energy around us which is invisible, but which is powerful and beautiful and has all sorts of meanings, you'd think I was a nut or a pariah, and I'd be lucky to stay out of jail as I am today. The same thing is true of LSD. LSD is like a microscope which opens up awareness of energies which are there, and I think will be used in the future as a form of education, as a form of self-growth. The microscope of LSD will help us see more, see faster, and see deeper.
That's an excerpt from a TV interview with Timothy Leary in the early 60s. Leary is one of the central figures in Don Lattin's new book. It's called The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. Lattin calls their experiences with psychedelic drugs the foundational myth of the 60s. He told Ann Strainchamps that it all started when Timothy Leary swallowed some magic mushrooms in Mexico in 1960.
He had this incredible trip, which he later described as the most profound religious experience of his life. And this was not a religious man. I mean, Timothy Leary was raised Catholic, but he was very, very much a secular, you know, academic, a clinical psychologist. And so were the other people who he would work with at Harvard. So they were very puzzled that they were having these religious experiences, mystical experiences, you know, a sense of awe and wonder and interconnectedness, you know, kind of stuff that the saints and sadhus have been talking about for centuries. So that's why they brought in another member of the club, who's a Houston Smith. He was a philosophy professor at MIT who knew Aldous Huxley and made some connections with them with Huxley there. He was their theological consultant in a way. They wanted to have him try these drugs, which Houston had not tried. Houston had been writing about mysticism, but he'd never, and meditating actually, for quite a few years, but he'd never had what he would call a full-blown mystical experience. So he wanted to try these drugs.
And what was Houston Smith's first experience like?
It's funny, you know, Houston's 90 years old. He lives in Berkeley. He took his first trip with Timothy Leary at Timothy Leary's house on New Year's Day, 1960-61. And when Houston talks about this, I mean, his eyes, you know, widen and he lights up like a little kid and he says, "Oh, Don, what a way to start the 60s. So, I mean, it looks like he has this enthusiasm like he's a little kid, you know, and this is like, and this is 50 years ago that this happened, you know. And he had both a revelatory and a terrifying experience on his first trip. I mean, he thought he had died. His body had disappeared. So his first experience was one of both awe and terror, which is important, I think, for people to remember when they if they try these drugs, which I'm not recommending, by the way. Mm-hmm. They can be very dangerous, especially from a psychological point of view.
One of the fascinating things about all of this is that, well, I guess it was Leary, mostly, who was so on fire from that first trip, from his first experience, that he came back just determined that he would share this with the world and that it would revolutionize psychology and maybe the entire Western culture.
Right. Yeah, he was. And he was just on a 3-year appointment at Harvard. And people forget that he was seen as a rising star in clinical psychology. And we remember him, you know, from later in the 60s as this kind of wild-eyed, you know, mad prophet, the high priest of LSD. But you have to remember, when this all started back at Harvard, the 60s hadn't really happened yet. What we think of as the 60s, you know, like San Francisco, the Grateful Dead, Indian bedspreads, you know, Jefferson Airplane. None of this had happened.
What was the Harvard Psychedelic Club like in its heyday?
Well, it started out as a research project, and the idea was, Leary's idea was that in the beginning, graduate students, not undergraduates, but undergraduate students would take these drugs, and initially it was psilocybin, not LSD, which is a similar effect, and they would write up reports about their experiences and talk about it. Then Leary did an experiment out at Concord Prison, a prison in Massachusetts, where he gave psilocybin to prisoners and actually took the graduate students, and Leary would take these drugs with the prisoners.
But then there were, during its heyday, I have the impression there were, you know, dozens of people kind of flowing in and out of Timothy Leary's house in Boston who were experimenting with psilocybin all the time, some of them affiliated with Harvard, but some not.
Right. It started out, like I say, as a serious research project, but it quickly morphed into something else. I mean, what it morphed into was really the beginning of the 60s counterculture. It really started right in Leary's living room in Newton, Massachusetts, where he had Allen Ginsberg in there taking psychedelics with various people. Alan Watts, the famous Buddhist scholar, came through. William Burroughs. But it quickly became a big party, and it got out of control very quickly, and that's why they got into trouble.
Well, at first, in those heady early days, it was all very exciting, and the people who were beginning to experiment, Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass, Houston Smith, Andrew Weil, everybody was sort of in the same mindset about this, but it all kind of fell apart. There were betrayals. You know, people broke up with each other. You've uncovered part of this story for the first time. Do you want to tell what happened?
A lot of people think they know what happened to Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert at Harvard, you know. But what's, I think, new in my book is it's really the first detailed account of the role that Andrew Weil played in all this. Andrew Weil was about a generation younger than the three other characters I've mentioned, Leary, Alpert, and Houston Smith. He was a freshman at Harvard when he first volunteered to be a research subject. Basically, what happened is he went with a friend of his named Ronnie Winston, and they volunteered to be research subjects. But Leary and Alpert had agreed to not use undergraduates, so they said they couldn't participate. Anyway, about a year later, what happened is Richard Alpert ran into Ronnie Winston, Weil's friend, at a party and wound up striking up a very close friendship with him, even though there was some sort of romantic attraction, and Alpert says, because he was a gay man living in the closet at the time, brought Ronnie Winston into the fold, and he started taking psilocybin with him, even though he was an undergraduate. This happened with other undergraduates. Andrew Weil basically got jealous. He didn't have most favored student status, and he wasn't part of the in crowd, so he basically brought them down by doing an expose in the Harvard Crimson, the student newspaper, and working as a spy for the Harvard administration simultaneously to gather evidence that undergraduates were being given these drugs, and went about it in some pretty heavy-handed ways, too. There's still hard feelings about this 50 years later. It's pretty incredible. I've interviewed all the, you know, surviving characters here. And
of course, they were all also taking huge quantities of drugs at the time. Didn't Leary say at some point he dropped acid 300 times?
Yeah, they both did. They were asked. I mean, Leary was asked at a notorious interview in Playboy, which was published in 1966. And I forget the number, but it's something like, you know, he had taken 238 LSD trips, you know, in the last few years. I mean, that's quite a bit. Anyone who's taken this drug, sort of, you know, their jaw drops when they hear that.
But it's maybe surprising to see their personal relationships getting shredded in the process.
Yeah, I mean, Alpert tells this one story about they had an experiment later on at this place called Millbrook, a mansion in upstate New York where they landed after getting kicked out of Harvard, where a group of them locked themselves in this house, this kind of side house on the estate, and they took a large dose of LSD every 4 hours for 2 weeks and thought they were maybe going to have some breakthrough and become all one with each other. And what wound up happening is they wound up hating each other. And there's all kinds of, you know, rants and recriminations. And it was actually one of the moments where I think Richard Alpert saw that LSD was not going to save the world and helped inspire him to go to India, become a spiritual teacher, and encourage people to find kinder and gentler ways to explore this same realm.
So it was after that that Leary pretty much found himself persona non grata in the U.S. and got kicked out of several other countries as well. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happened to each of the four men you profiled.
Well, I mean, Leary led such a fascinating life. He was kicked out of Harvard. They were kicked out of three countries in the next 6 months, Mexico and two Caribbean countries. They landed in Millbrook, beautiful 3,000-acre estate with a 64-room mansion in upstate New York. And they were there in the mid-60s. It was like the psychedelic Disneyland. It was pretty notorious. And then O'Leary came out to San Francisco. He ran for governor of California against Ronald Reagan. O'Leary's campaign slogan was Come Together, which helped inspire the Beatles song Come Together. There's actually three Beatles songs you can attribute to O'Leary. Richard Nixon called Timothy O'Leary the most dangerous man in America, to which O'Leary replied, oh, yeah? Well, I have America surrounded, which is a classic O'Leary line. But the CIA was after him, and he was thrown in prison for a very minor marijuana charge. He escaped from prison in Southern California with the help of the weather underground, specifically with William Ayers, who we've heard about recently as Barack Obama's so-called terrorist pal. Remember that? Bill Ayers and Bernadette Dorin. He escaped from prison, was smuggled to Algeria, was taken in by the Black Panthers and Eldridge Cleaver, who were living in exile in Algeria at the time. Eldridge Cleaver and O'Leary had a falling out. And basically, O'Leary was being kept prisoner by the Black Panthers then in Algeria. They were trying to re-educate him and get him to denounce LSD, which he wouldn't do. He had escaped from the Panthers. He went to Switzerland. He lived for a couple of years in Switzerland, wound up in Afghanistan, where he was kidnapped by the CIA, these extraordinary renditions. They happened back then, too. And brought back to prison. Later becomes a government snitch to get out of jail, loses a lot of his friends on the left. You know, the story goes on. I mean,
in some ways, the more interesting part of your story in terms of the later effect on our culture, an effect we're still living with, is what happened to Houston Smith and Andrew Weil.
In a funny way, O'Leary probably had the least effect, certainly the least positive effect. Whereas Andrew Weil, as many people know, you know, went on to write several best-selling books about holistic health, calling for a true reformation of the, you know, healthcare system in this country. He's had PBS series. He was put on the cover of Time magazine twice in the 90s, named one of the 25 most influential men in America.
And I think credits some of his insights or some of his interest in alternative medicine or mind-body medicine to his early experiments with LSD.
Yes, he does. He says it was having this new way of looking at the connection between his mind and body and his spirit, how what happens in his mind can actually have a physical effect in his body. That was one of the things that got him originally interested in alternative medicine.
So in that sense, you can say that the influence of LSD is still with us. And Houston Smith?
Houston Smith, he had a falling out with O'Leary, too. He thought O'Leary was a bit of a megalomaniac, which I think he was. But Houston Smith went back to the classroom and, you know, taught for decades. His book, The World's Religions, is the kind of Bible for interfaith movement and the world's religions. He's done more than anyone, I think, to encourage tolerance of other people's faith. And then, of course, you have Ram Dass, who started out as Richard Alpert. I mean, he became one of the most important spiritual teachers of my generation, the baby boom generation, and encouraged many people to explore Buddhism and Hinduism and different kinds of meditative practices. So, you know, in terms of religion, spirituality, medicine, health and well-being, I think those are the main ways you see the effect of all this, at least as expressed through these three men's careers.
Don Lattin is the author of The Harvard Psychedelic Club. He talked with Anne Strainchamps.
Now, in our culture, we've been trained for individual differences to stand out. So you look at each person, the immediate hit is brighter, dumber, older, younger, richer, poorer, and we make all these dimensional distinctions, put them in categories, and treat them that way. And we get so that we only see others as separate from ourselves. And one of the dramatic characteristics of the psychedelic experience is being with another person and suddenly seeing the ways in which they are like you, not different from you.
That's Richard Alpert, back in the early 60s. For decades, Carl Jung's Red Book remained the most famous unpublished book in the history of psychology. Jung refused to publish it during his lifetime, and his heirs kept it locked up after he died. The Red Book recorded Jung's visionary paintings and laid out his radical ideas for a new kind of psychology. Now, finally, it's been published, thanks largely to the dogged efforts of Jungian psychologist Sonu Shamdasani. As Shamdasani told Steve Paulson, Jung couldn't really capture the complexity of our inner lives in his academic papers. So he started the Red Book, where he wrote down his dreams and conjured up images from what he called active imaginations.
He would enter into a state of reverie in which he induced fantasies in a waking state. He would then engage with the characters that appeared and enter into dialogue with them. But critically, he would then step out of this and attempt to analyze and comprehend what had taken place.
Can you describe one of these, or maybe pick one of the images in the Red Book and talk about where it came from and how he worked with it?
One dream depicted near the beginning of the text is he finds himself in a mountain range with a youth and finds that they hear a horn, and it's that of the Germanic hero Siegfried, and they find that they have to kill Siegfried, which they do, and he feels a great sense of remorse at this act. He then tries to ponder what the significance of the slaying of the hero means, and comes to think that what is required is that one has to sacrifice one's heroism, and that the failure to do this at a societal level led to part of the conflict which culminated in World War I. And instead of slaying the hero within themselves, they killed each other.
And it's worth pointing out that he started work on this book in what, 1913?
Yes.
Which was right at the dawn of World War I.
Yes.
Now, there's also been a fair amount of speculation that Carl Jung himself had reached some sort of personal crisis, and that the Red Book was, in a way, his way to work out the issues that he was dealing at a very personal, maybe a spiritual level.
The work begins with a realization that he'd lost his soul, that he had accomplished everything that he'd set out to do. He'd married, had a fulfilling family life. He had a very successful career and made a name for himself in psychology and psychiatry. But he'd lost meaning. And this is his attempt to reconnect with his soul and refine meaning within his life.
What did the soul mean to Carl Jung?
Good question. It begins with Jung's acknowledgement of all those aspects of his life which he denied.
What were some of the parts of his personality he had disowned?
For instance, he'd been a thinker, so he had neglected pleasure. He'd dedicated himself to scholarly study. He'd neglected feeling.
So he'd become too cerebral, I guess would be one way you could put it.
Yes.
Now, there's another side to this. I mean, when you look at the paintings he made that are now reproduced in the Red Book, there's a lot of dark imagery here. I mean, there are monsters and demons, and I mean, there certainly is the sense that he is exploring the shadow self. I mean, whether it's his own shadow, I don't know.
Well, it is a journey to hell in which he encounters everything, as we were discussing, that he disowned in his life and realizes that these two are part of life and need to be affirmed.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion over the years about Jung's relationship with Freud, who was his colleague. And I mean, it's often been said that Freud was once Jung's mentor, and then Jung famously broke away from Freud. Is the Red Book to some degree a product of Jung's break with Freud?
I think there's more truth in the reverse, in that when Jung returns to his own core spiritual values, it's clear that he's moving in a universe of ideas that has little to do with Freudian psychoanalysis. And the time of his association with Freud rather took place in a period in his life of alienation. Jung himself stressed that his teachers in the first instance were the psychologist Theodore Flournoy, Pierre Janet, and the psychiatrist Eugen Bleuler. These were the people he studied with and had far greater shape on his subsequent thinking than his encounter with Freud.
Now, one thing that I should mention is this is a beautiful book. I mean, the book that we have before us now is an exact reproduction of Jung's Red Book as he created it back in his day, and it's full of incredible paintings and meticulous calligraphy. Did you realize he was such a talented artist?
The extent and the quality of the work took me by surprise. He certainly could have made a name for himself as an artist had he so chosen.
Well, and I'm trying to think of the kind of tradition that this reminds me of. I guess I almost think of the medieval illuminated manuscripts.
That clearly is one of the prototypes. The work itself looks like something that could have come out of the Middle Ages. And this has appeared in Jung's subsequent work, where he sees something critical happen in the West, namely a separation between science and religion.
So that was part of his project, to bring science and religion back together.
That's what he dedicated decades of his life to. Mm-hmm. And through attempting to develop a psychology of religion, he was not attempting to engage in theology. So he was sort of trying to separate the question of belief in the tenets of religious doctrine, but to say, look, regardless of whether these things are true or not, this is something that plays a large role in the makeup of our lives, and we need to understand it, and we need to understand what functions that it has.
Now, one of the fascinating aspects of this whole story of the Red Book is that it developed its own life after Carl Jung died in 1961, because for most of those years since then, his heirs kept it locked up. Why was his family so protective of this book?
To begin with, Jung didn't leave clear instructions. He left it in his will to his family. He clearly had decided not to publish it in his own lifetime, but he knew it would emerge into public scrutiny one day. His family had not been engaged in the publication of his works. He'd kept a strict separation between his family life and his professional life. And they suddenly were confronted with a vast literary estate of massive proportions after he died. And the Red Book had been somewhat of a taboo object. So when I came along and raised the subject in 1997, no one at that point, to my mind, who was living in the family, had read it.
It's kind of an extraordinary story. I mean, you're saying that Jung's heirs had this Red Book in their possession, but they didn't know what to do with it, and they didn't understand it. I mean, it this hugely important book, but it was a great mystery. It was sort of like the black hole within all that we knew about Carl Jung.
It is a remarkable situation where you have a whole psychological movement that's had significant effects on 20th century thought, based in part on a work which no one had read or seen.
Sonu Shamdasani is a historian of psychology at University College London and the editor of Carl Jung's Red Book. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You will see images of Jung's extraordinary paintings from the Red Book on our website at ttbook.org, where you can also comment on today's program. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a CD of this show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Mind and Body, number 321A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.